Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live, Friday edition. We got a little bit of a special episode today, 2 hours of internet open forum with Jimmy Akin, which is, we try to do fun stuff on Fridays sometimes. We try to just change it up a little bit, and that is one way to do it, do internet open forum with Jimmy Akin. I'm feeling very pre-recorded today. I don't know how you feeling, Jimmy.
Oh, I'm feeling very recorded as well.
Well, thanks for doing it with us. Very much appreciated. Jimmy, if you don't know, is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, long-time Catholic apologist, author of many books, and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where nowadays, everywhere I go, recently, Jimmy, I was out with Dr. David Anders in the Imperial Valley for an event, and people come up and say, I just love Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and I'm glad they say it. But I kind of try to pretend like I have something to do with it. Yeah, aren't we doing great over there?
Well, you do sometimes appear on the show.
Well, that's true.
When we do weird question shows, we rely on weird questions that you and I have taken on.
Yeah, yeah. So what dropped this morning on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
It's part two of our look at the Seventh-day Adventist prophetess Ellen Gould White. Last week, we told the story of her life, including, you know, the background and how she started having visions. We even talked about a particularly cool vision where she got to see other planets.
Oh, yeah.
And like on one of the planets, she saw the patriarch Enoch and stuff like that. So
that's where he went. I bet.
Well, no. She asked him.
Yeah.
She asked in the vision, she asked Enoch if this planet is where he went when he was taken. And he said, no, I live in the heavenly city, but I'm just visiting.
Oh, yeah.
So he was just there temporarily. But today we go into analysis mode. And so we look at, so what's the evidence regarding were these real visions or not? Was she really a prophetess or not? And I'm doing it a little bit differently than the way I normally see the subject approached, because normally I see a lot of people essentially turn it into a theological fight where it's like, okay, she said she had this false theological belief, therefore she couldn't have been a true prophetess. But that only works if you assume a particular theological perspective. And so it's not of tremendous use. You know, like if you're talking to a Seventh-day Adventist and you say, well, she had a false belief. Well, if the Seventh-day Adventist believes that belief and doesn't think it's false, they're not going to find your argument convincing. So I'm trying to approach this in a religiously neutral, evidential way and say, what is, taking the religious considerations out of it, what does the evidence say about whether these were genuine divine revelations or not?
You can find Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World just by typing in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, or you can go to mysterious.fm and find it there. 888, no, oh, Jimmy, I almost gave out the number on an internet
open forum. You almost did.
That's bad. But it's so hard not to. It's like my one job is to give out the phone number. Slowly and in a way that people can understand it. That's basically my job.
And you sometimes succeed.
Occasionally I have succeeded. Not during pledge drives, unless I am quite forcefully reminded. It takes teams of people to get me to slow down and just say the number. One thing I have learned from you is that often you can blame demons and aliens. And now we got a demon and alien question to start out with. Or I guess you are being somewhat sardonic when you say that, because people do tend to go to the demons and aliens explanations.
A little too readily.
Yes. Randall asks this, Jimmy. I would like to hear a response to Professor Daniel O'Connor's claim that aliens cannot exist according to Catholic teaching and that they must be the work of demons.
Okay, so I guess I'd like to start out by saying that, you know, personally, I like Daniel O'Connor. He and I have notable disagreements on a number of different subjects, but I've had positive personal interactions with him, including on some sensitive subjects. He, at least at one point, I don't know his current views on this, but at least at one point, he was a supporter of Father Michel Rodrigue, who is a Canadian priest who claims to be a visionary. And I looked into Father Rodrigue's claims and concluded that he's not, that he's a fabulist. But I always want to check myself and make sure my facts are accurate and be very fair and charitable. And so after I'd written a script on Father Rodrigue, I ran it past Daniel O'Connor and said, tell me if I'm wrong on anything. And he was a really classy guy, even though I was critiquing and rejecting the claims of a visionary that he supported, at least at the time. He was very respectful and very cooperative, and I really appreciated interacting with him. So I just want to say, based on my interactions, he's been a really classy guy. Having said that, so what's his argument that aliens cannot exist according to the Catholic Church? He's not making a scientific argument. He's making a theological argument. And his argument is based on the Catechism of the Catholic Church. In paragraph 356, the first sentence reads thusly, of all visible creatures, only man is able to know and love his creator. And so that's the sentence that he rests his argument on. Of all visible creatures, only man is able to know and love the creator. So if aliens, you know, exist, intelligent extraterrestrials, they would be visible creatures like we are. They would have bodies of visible matter and so forth. And if they're genuinely intelligent the way we are, you would expect them also to be able to know and love the creator, because natural human reason is able to prove the existence of a creator. And if aliens were visible creatures and they had reason the way we do, they should be able to reason to the existence of the creator, even if God had not chosen to reveal himself to them. So you would expect them to be able to know and love their creator. And here the Catechism says that of all visible creatures, only man is able to do this. Now, one of the things that frequently happens when people have a particular opinion is they want to find a way to say, the church teaches this. And they will then review church documents and they will find a passage that kind of sounds like maybe what their own view is. And then they will take that passage and take it in isolation from other things that the magisterium has said and make an absolute of it and say, so this is all we need to look at. And this clearly teaches what my view is.
Yeah.
And this is a very dangerous procedure, because the magisterium doesn't just say one thing in a single passage. It doesn't have, you read magisterial documents, they haven't framed their sentences usually as complete, you know, statements of a truth that have no further qualifications. And so the context will clarify what they say. One of the things, and I've seen in Daniel's videos, he will in particular emphasize the word all in this, and he'll say all means all. So if all visible creatures, you know, that's not just here on earth, that's going to be everywhere, all visible creatures. But the problem is that this is overcranking the language. Mm-hmm. It's not to be unkind, but it's a form of logic chopping, where you overemphasize certain things in a way that the language itself is being taken in a more absolute way than it actually gets used. And the word all is an example of that. You know, here he's focusing on all visible creatures, but we find parallel expressions in scripture, like all men. Okay. And if you look, if you search on in the New Testament for the phrase all men, you will very quickly run into examples that where all is being used, but it can't be being used in an absolute sense. For example, if you look in Mark 5:20, Jesus has just exorcised the Gerasene demoniac. And it says that he went among the Decapolis, which was a group of 10 cities, and told how much Jesus had done for him. And then Mark says, and all men marveled.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
He just said all.
Right.
Does that mean really all men everywhere marveled, like people over in Scotland?
No.
We're marveling at what Jesus had done for the Gerasene demoniac, or people in China were marveling at what Jesus had done for the Gadarene demoniac, or people in South America were marveling at what Jesus had done for the Gadarene demoniac, also known as the Gerasene demoniac. Obviously not. All men, even though the word all is used, it's more restricted in scope. Mark has what philosophers sometimes call a universe of discourse, where he's talking about a limited group, and within that group, all men marveled, you know, some social circle that was aware of the Gadarene demoniac, or, you know, people who had heard what the Gadarene demoniac was saying. Well, those people marveled. You find similar expressions, and that's not unique. You find similar expressions elsewhere. You look at the beginning of Luke, and it's talking about the ministry of John the Baptist. And in Luke 3:15, John the Baptist says, Luke says, as the people were in expectation, all men questioned in their hearts whether John the Baptist might be the Christ. So really, again, we've got the word all, and all means all.
Right, right.
So those people in Scotland and China and South America were really wondering if John the Baptist might be the Christ, if you take the word all in an absolute way. And so these illustrations show us that, you know, you can't just camp out on the word all. You have to be sensitive to the context. So what do we find when we look at the context in paragraph 356 of the Catechism? Does all visible creatures mean all visible creatures anywhere in the universe? Or does it mean all visible creatures we know about? Or does it mean all visible creatures here on Earth? You know, what's the universe of discourse for this? Well, the very next sentence clarifies. After saying that of all visible creatures, only man is able to know and love his Creator, the next sentence says, he, meaning man, is the only creature on earth that God has willed for its own sake. So this shows us that, based on the context, the all visible creatures we're discussing are the ones here on earth. It's not trying to address all visible creatures elsewhere in the universe. In fact, you know, how would the authors of the Catechism even know what pertains to other visible creatures in distant galaxies? You know, they don't have knowledge of distant galaxies. How would they even make a judgment about such beings if they have no knowledge of other locations? You know, Scripture doesn't say there are no aliens. You know, there's no basis for the authors of the Catechism to make such a judgment.
Right.
And so right there, we see a problem. But we can go a little further, because it's pretty easy to show that the authors of the Catechism were not trying to address the situation of extraterrestrials. And one way we can show that is by looking at what the chief architect of the Catechism has had to say on the subject. The Catechism was prepared under the auspices of Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict XVI. And so, of all people, he is able to speak to what was in the mind of the authors of the Catechism. And he's been asked about extraterrestrials. Now, personally, he's a little skeptical. You know, he says that thus far we've failed in finding them and so forth, so he's a little skeptical. But in the year 2000, so this is after the Catechism, which came out in 1992, in the book, interview book, God and the World with Peter Sewald, Sewald asked him, is it then so inconceivable that somewhere beyond our own tiny world in this immeasurable universe, there may exist other creatures of God, perhaps even humans similar to ourselves? And without quoting everything he says, here's what Benedict said. It seems somehow obvious to suppose that we cannot be alone in this great immeasurable ocean of stars. We cannot absolutely exclude this hypothesis, because we have no cognizance of the whole breadth of God's thought and his creative work. Yet it is a fact that thus far all attempts to discover anything of this kind has failed. So he acknowledges, he's a little skeptical, but he says we cannot absolutely exclude this hypothesis that aliens exist. He says what we can say is simply, we do not know. So contrary to Daniel's reading of the Catechism, Cardinal Ratzinger read it in a way that restricted the all visible creatures to meaning those here on Earth. It wasn't trying to talk about other worlds. And so he says, we don't know.
Yeah.
That's all we can really say right now. Sewald then asked him a follow-up question, which is very interesting and pertains to the how would the authors of the Catechism even know question. Sewald asked, would it be shown in Revelation if we had relatives somewhere in space? You know, would God have told us about that in the Bible? Well, Pope Benedict, Cardinal Ratzinger responded by saying, not necessarily. Because God had no intention of recounting everything to us. Revelation was not there to give us a complete knowledge of God's ideas and of all space with no gaps in it. One of the wisdom books, often quoted by the fathers, says about this in one place, God has given us the world to argue about. Scientific knowledge is, so to speak, the adventure that he has left to us ourselves. In Revelation, on the other hand, he tells us only as much about himself as is needed for life and death. So Cardinal Ratzinger says God is not under any obligation to tell us in Revelation about whether there are intelligent creatures on other planets. And so to emphasize his own conclusion, what we can say is simply, we do not know. And that, I think, is a strong indicator that the authors of the Catechism were not trying to rule out alien life in this passage.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid Daniel is simply misreading the text.
Randall, thanks very much for that question. Professor Daniel O'Connor was the professor who had made that point. We got to take our quick break. We'll be right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Unplanned, the true story of Abby Johnson.
I would be the youngest director in Planned Parenthood history.
She believed in a woman's right to choose.
I've had an abortion myself, so I don't have any problem with another woman making the same decision.
Until the day she saw something that changed everything.
Tiny, perfect little baby. And then it was just gone.
Now she's pulling back the curtain on the abortion industry. Unplanned.
Available at EWTNRC.com and the EWTN app.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's an internet open forum with Jimmy today. All of our questions having come from the internet, and we're about to enter into a little cycle of feasts that the church gets into in the month of November when we pray for the dead. We remember the saintly dead. We remember those who are dead who are whose condition we don't know, whether they're in purgatory or in heaven, and we pray for them. And all of that is preceded by Halloween.
You know what that little sequence of days is called or used to be called on the liturgical calendar?
No.
Well, since it's based around Halloween or around All Hallows Day, I should say.
Yeah.
Hallow means holy, and so a hallow is a saint.
Yeah.
It's called Hallowtide.
Ah, we're coming into
Hallowtide.
So much easier just to say that. Coming into Hallowtide. So, of course, we're going to get some questions on Halloween. And so the first one comes from Matthew. I think a lot would like to know about whether Catholics can celebrate Halloween.
Well, so Halloween is the eve, that's the ween part, of All Hallows Day. That's the hallow part. And since All Hallows Day is a holy day, the eve, and holy days are things we celebrate, including the eve of holy days, you can certainly celebrate Halloween. The question is just in what form. Now, some people will, we go to church on All Hallows Day. You can go early on the eve of All Hallows Day if you want. That would be one way of celebrating it. Some people have their kids dress up as saints. You can do that if you want. I think what Matthew and its father, Matthew of the Legionaries of Christ, I think what he primarily has in mind is the kind of modern celebration of Halloween, where the kids dress up, and sometimes adults, not as saints, but as something, sometimes even as monsters, and where they get candy and things like that. Well, you know, or listen to scary stories or watch scary movies or things like that. Well, there's nothing wrong with any of that in principle. There's nothing wrong with playing dress up, including as a monster. God built play into human beings and other creatures. That's why kittens and puppies play fight. It's why human children play. You know, boys will often play fight. Girls will play with dolls. And what the purpose of play is to prepare us for situations that we may later encounter. And so it's a way of safely engaging in a kind of low stakes environment, whereas in the future, the stakes may be ramped up. So puppies and kittens will get into fights as adult dogs and cats, and they need to have some experience of what it's like to be in a fight. But since they're not yet adults, it needs to be safe. So they will play fight. Same thing. That's why little boys play fight, too. You know, they may play cops and robbers or whatever it is, but they engage in safe or relatively safe mock battles because they may have to fight as men. Women, you know, when they play with dolls, you know, like have baby dolls or tea parties or things like that, they're preparing in a low stakes way for something that will be more significant later on. If you've got a baby, you really need to take care of that baby. And so it helps to have some play practice. And so that's the purpose of play. But in play, there needs to be drama. There, and someone, you know, needs to be playing the aggressor or whatever. And so there's nothing wrong in principle with dressing up as a monster. There's nothing wrong with getting candy. You know, now you don't want to take trick or treat to the extreme of you're going to burn someone's house down if they don't give you candy. I mean, the trick part of trick or treat is these days more of a formality. It's really just a candy gathering custom today. And there's nothing wrong with gathering candy. There's nothing wrong with watching a scary movie or listening to a scary story. Those are just mental forms of play that perform the same function as regular play. You know, you put yourself in this safe experience of watching a scary movie, and it helps you learn how to handle the emotion of fear. And so there's nothing wrong in principle with any of that. Obviously, you don't want to do it in such a way that it actually glorifies evil. But just as a kind of play experience, there's nothing wrong with it.
Father Matthew, thank you very much for that question. Another internet Halloween question for Jimmy. This one comes from Bo. In honor of Halloween, could you explain the common misconceptions by Protestants and some Catholics that Halloween is a pagan or demonic holiday?
Yeah. So these kind of twin claims both involve errors in reasoning. First of all, with regard to it being pagan, most people today don't know the historical origins of Halloween. The American celebration of Halloween is based on customs that were largely based, I mean, before commercialization got a hold of it. It was based on customs that were brought to the United States by Celtic immigrants from Ireland and Scotland. And the thing is, these people immigrated in the 1700s and 1800s. So paganism was long dead by the time they came over.
Right.
So there's no real pagan connection here. You look at customs like jack-o'-lanterns and things like that, and they're actually connected historically with customs of praying for the dead. Now, they didn't use pumpkins in Ireland and Scotland because they didn't have pumpkins. Instead, they would use sometimes turnips, and they would make jack-o'-lanterns out of turnips and put a little light inside, and it would represent the soul of a departed person that you could then pray for. So, you know, these are actually Christian customs that have been modified through folk processes and commercialism, but there's no real connection with paganism. When it comes to demons, well, if people have the idea that something is pagan, they frequently will say, oh, it must be demonic, which is not true. You know, there are all kinds of pagan things that have been absorbed into culture that aren't demonic at all. Like, for example, Cy Kellett, do you wear a wedding ring?
I do indeed, Jimmy.
Yeah, well, that's pagan, so it's demonic. You better rip it off your finger and throw it away. Would your wife like that?
She would not.
You to do that?
Fact,
she would not.
No, I thought I better consult with her even before I took your advice on that.
Yeah, well, so wedding rings were something that pagans came up with, but that didn't make them demonic. And people don't need to be hypersensitive and see demons under every rock. As long as you're doing it wholesomely, there's nothing demonic here.
Got to take our first break. It's Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin. Lots and lots of great questions from the Internet to come. We'll do that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's an internet open forum for this Friday afternoon. Maybe it's Friday evening. Maybe it's even Saturday morning where you are. We have our friend James in the Philippines who calls and says good morning when he calls. He says happy Saturday morning whenever he calls on a Friday afternoon. Hello, James. Wherever you are, we're glad you're here with us. All the questions came from the internet, so you can just relax and enjoy the questions and the answers. Let's see. This one comes from Mark. And Mark asks another Halloween question. We're working our way through the Halloween questions. If Halloween existed during the time of Christ, would he recommend it? Trick or treat, wearing of costumes, family gatherings, etc., to Joseph, Mary, and the apostles?
Well, so Jesus was, at least when he was a boy, I mean, what we're doing here is we're transplanting a modern cultural idea onto their culture because Halloween didn't exist in first century Palestine. And if you're wondering, would Jesus have celebrated Halloween? Well, he would have been little at the time and wouldn't have been recommending it to people, presumably. But if, as an adult, you went to Jesus and said, hey, time has been rewritten, and now we have this Halloween custom here in first century Palestine, and lots of Jewish people are having their kids dress up as monsters and get candy and go to parties. What do you think of that? Well, Jesus was not portrayed in the New Testament as an uptight killjoy.
I think that's a good point. Yeah, I never noticed that about Jesus. Not an uptight killjoy. Yeah.
He, you know, in fact, was criticized by some people as, oh, he's a glutton and a wine drinker. You know, so he enjoyed, you know, gustatory pleasures and things like that. He celebrated Jewish holidays. And if this was a custom, if they did have All Hallows Day in his day, and if they did have an prior evening celebration of it, he wouldn't have had a problem with that in principle. He wouldn't have had a problem with kids getting candy. He wouldn't have had a problem with people playing dress up, especially as kids. He wouldn't have had a problem with people getting together for parties. They got together for parties in his own day. Now, of course, he would criticize distortions. You know, if someone is genuinely glorifying evil, well, he's not going to be in favor of that. But but he at least from, and of course we're speculating here because, you know, that's the nature of this question. But on the basis of what we see in scripture, he didn't have a problem with cultural expressions. And as long as it's being done in a reasonable way that doesn't violate any moral principles, he wouldn't have a problem with, hey, let's let the kids get some candy and have some fun and go to a party.
Mark, thank you very much for that.
Mark has a second question.
He does indeed. All right, we move on to a purgatory question from Mark. If the word, and he puts it in quote, purgatory, he's talking about the word purgatory, was explicitly mentioned by Christ in the Gospels, would all Protestants believe in it?
Well, it's hard to say all when, I mean, the word all and Protestants and the word Protestants typically doesn't go together because there's such an enormous diversity of opinion in the Protestant community on various matters. But if Christ had used the word purgatory, which was not actually coined until a few centuries later in Latin, but if he had used the word and if it were translated as purgatory in English translations, then it would be something that Protestants would take seriously because they take the words of Jesus seriously. There might be some Protestants here or there who would try to say, oh, it's been mistranslated or something like that. But by and large, the majority of Protestants would accept it because they would hear their Lord, you know, describing it. They might not understand purgatory in exactly the same way that Catholics do, but they would take it very seriously, and that's to their credit because they take Jesus's word seriously by and large.
Mark, thank you for both of those questions. Appreciate it. I almost did it, Jimmy. I almost gave out the phone number.
But you stopped yourself. You triumphed.
I know. Look at that. Look at that self-control I'm developing. James wants to know this. Oh, this here's an easy one from James. This is no problem. I'd love to better understand being outside of time.
Yeah, who wouldn't? So to shed a little bit of light on it, and there's a limit to how much light we can shed because it's in part because this is radio, and so I have to give a short radio answer. I can't write you a book on the subject and give it to you over the air. There's also a limit because of our minds are designed to work in a linear fashion, in a linear sequential fashion. So our intellects are inherently bound by time. But I can say a little bit here. The classical definition of eternity, being outside of time, was given by the philosopher Boethius in his Consolation of Philosophy, which was a work that he wrote. He was he lived in the early centuries after Christ, and he was, even though he was living in a Christian age after the empire had converted, he got in some trouble and was kind of on death row. But he wrote this book called The Consolation of Philosophy, and in it he gave us the classical definition of what eternity is. And the way Boethius defined it, eternity is the simultaneous possession of the, well, I'm trying to say it simply, but it's the simultaneous possession of everlasting life. So for God, who is outside of time, he has everlasting life. There is no time at which God does not exist. But because God is out, so there's, you know, there's no day on which you look up and say, oh, there's no God who's real. You know, God always exists. So viewed from a perspective inside of time, God's life is everlasting. But because time does not pass for God, he possesses all of that everlasting life all at once, simultaneously. It's not like us. You know, I'm Jimmy Akin. I'm inside of time. My life passes in sequence. I have one moment of it right now. I'll have another moment of it in a minute. I had another moment of it a while back. but I only experience my life in little chunks. Whereas for God, being outside of time, he has no sequentiality in his own experience. And so he comprehends all of time all at once, and it does not pass for him because he is outside of the progression of temporal passing. Now, that's a little hard to wrap your mind around. The way I commonly think of it, this is a helpful metaphor, is of like being in a museum and looking at a mural, because murals frequently are chronological. They will tell stories, you know, like here in San Diego, this is actually on a like on a not an underpass, but it's like a big concrete thing on the freeway. Yeah. They have a mural of the civil rights movement. And so you see, you know, like Martin Luther King at one point in the mural, and you see other people at other points in the mural. And you go to museums and you'll frequently see murals that will tell stories. But as a person who's outside of the mural, you can see the whole mural all at once. You can just take a step back, see the entire thing all at once. And that's kind of like what it is for God to view history. He can see all of history all at once. He can also, and this is kind of the finger painting mural thing, he can also interact with history at all points all at once. So it's kind of like he's actually composing the mural all at once in a kind of timeless manner. And so not only does he see all of history all at once, he also interacts with all of history all at once.
James, thank you for that simple, simple question. Appreciate it. Linda asks this. If Adam did not take a bite of the apple Eve gave him, would there have been a fall?
Well, we really don't know. It's going to depend. This is not a matter of doctrine. So the church does not have a teaching on this. This is a matter of theological speculation. And there have been different theories about exactly how our inheritance of the fall worked. According to one theory, Adam was what sometimes called the federal head of the human race. And that meant he's the leader, he's the one that determines the way the whole thing goes. And so one way of looking at this federal headship theology of the fall would be to say that Adam was the one that really doomed the human, Adam alone was the one that really caused the human race as an entity to fall. If Eve had eaten the fruit alone and Adam had not, then on this view, Eve might have been the only person to fall. But because Adam did not fall, none of Adam's descendants would have fallen. On the other hand, you can take a more cooperative view of Adam and Eve's relationship to the human race and say, hey, they both contributed to the biology of the later human race. You know, we got both of their genes. They could have equally both contributed to the fall of the human race, in which case, even if Adam had not eaten the fruit, Eve's fallenness might have prevented original righteousness from being passed down to her descendants, which would include everybody. And so as a result, even if Adam had not fallen, the human race might have fallen simply because Eve did. And you could even say maybe we fell twice as hard because they both fell. Maybe if only one of them had fallen, we would only be half as bad off as we are. But it's really a matter of speculation and we don't know.
Linda, thank you very much for that question. It's time to take our break. We're doing an internet open forum with Jimmy Akin. All these questions have come from the internet, and lots more of them to come right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
He is only one of four popes honored as the great.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Leo I was Pope at a time when Roman civilization was being overrun by barbarian armies. He stood as a light in the darkness and even saved the city of Rome from destruction by Attila and the Huns. Leo died in 461.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Heading into a big... Which day is Halloween? Halloween Sunday or Monday? Monday. I was going to say a Halloween weekend, but Monday is Halloween.
It's a Halloween weekend.
I'm sure there'll be lots of Halloween stuff this weekend. This question comes from Luke. Luke says, I have heard that a mass must be complete and not stop, even in an emergency. At what point must a priest not stop mass? Is it during the liturgy of the Eucharist or just specifically at the consecration or another time?
Okay, so it is not true that mass must never be stopped even in an emergency. If there's an earthquake and the church falls down on you, you can stop mass. If you're at mass and a gunman runs into the church, you know, ready to shoot it up, you can stop mass. There are certain things that will have to be done, but it is always possible to at least temporarily pause the mass in order to deal with an emergency. Now, there are a couple of texts that are relevant to this. One of them is from the Code of Canon Law. In the Code of Canon Law, Canon 927, it says this: it is absolutely forbidden, and in Latin, the word that they use is nefas, which means absolutely under no circumstances is this ever to happen. But it says it is absolutely forbidden, even in extreme urgent necessity, to consecrate one matter or the other or even both outside of the Eucharistic celebration. So you can never consecrate a host or a chalice or both unless you're doing it in the context of the Mass. That sets one parameter on this. You do need to have a Mass if you're going to have a consecration of the elements. But it doesn't tell us much about how that Mass proceeds and what happens if an emergency occurs during it. For that, we want to look at a document that's actually no longer printed in the Roman Missal. It was printed in the Roman Missal prior up to 1962. The document is called De Defectibus, which means on defects. The full title is like on defects occurring in the Mass. But it deals with all kinds of things that can go wrong in the Mass. You know, like I've mentioned some of them to you before, like what if you're celebrating Mass in a really cold environment and you're the priest and you look down and realize the wine has frozen?
Oh, yeah, right.
You know, right. Or what do you do if a rat carries away a precious host? Or what do you do if a spider falls in the chalice? It's got loads of interesting things about what could go wrong. And in sections 32 and 33, it deals with this subject of when is it okay to pause a Mass or even abandon the celebration of a Mass. In section 32, it says, if while the priest is celebrating Mass, the church is violated before he has reached the canon, which means the Eucharistic prayer. So any time up to the beginning of the Eucharistic prayer, the Mass is to be discontinued. Meaning if the church is violated any point before the Eucharistic prayer, you just stop Mass. You don't have to restart it later. You just can abandon the Mass. The Mass is to be discontinued. What if it's not then? Well, if after the canon, it is not to be discontinued. So once the priest starts the Eucharistic prayer, you need to finish the Mass. But that doesn't mean that you need to finish it right this minute. You can pause it. If there is fear of an attack by enemies or a flood or of the collapse of the building where the Mass is being celebrated, the Mass is to be discontinued if it is before the consecration. So that's in. So now we're talking about the period before, after the beginning of the Eucharistic prayer and before the consecration. If this fear arises after the consecration, however, you can expedite the Mass. It says the priest may omit everything else and go on at once to the reception of the sacrament. So if he's done the consecration or is in the midst of doing the consecration and enemies are about to attack, he can just quickly finish the consecration, receive the Eucharist, and skip the rest.
Ah, yeah.
Okay. What happens, though, if the priest himself becomes incapacitated during the celebration of the Mass? Well, that's what's dealt with in section 33 of De Defectibus. It says, if before the consecration, the priest becomes seriously ill or faints or dies, the Mass is discontinued. So if he hasn't started the consecration, you can just stop the Mass. You don't need to finish it later. If this happens after the consecration of the body only and before the consecration of the blood, or after both have been consecrated, then the Mass is to be completed. Okay, so you can't abandon it at this point. If he's consecrated the host or the blood or both, you got to finish the Mass. But if he's just died, how do you do that?
Right.
It's to be completed by another priest from the place where the first priest stopped, in case of necessity, even by a priest who is not fasting. So you've got a priest saying Mass. He says, you know, the consecration and then dies. Go over to the rectory, get another priest, even if he's not fasting, bring him in and let him complete the Mass from the point where the priest died. Where the first priest died. If the priest has not died, but has become ill and is still able to receive communion, and there is no other consecrated host at hand, the priest who is completing the Mass should divide the host, give one part to the sick priest, and consume the other part himself. So if the first priest is still alive and able to receive communion, you want him to participate, since it was his Mass, you want him to participate in receiving communion as long as he's able to do so. If the priest, now here's where it gets really interesting. If the priest has died after half saying the formula for the consecration of the body, so he's like, on the night he was betrayed, the Lord Jesus took bread and said to his disciples, and he dies. What do you do then? He's only half said the formula. Well, so if he's only half said the formula for the consecration of the body, then there is no consecration because he didn't get it all out. He didn't get, this is my body.
Right.
And since the consecration has not been done, there is no need for another priest to complete the Mass. So it's not just he gets to the beginning of the consecration. He's got to do the consecration of the host.
Right.
Half saying it's not going to count. If, on the other hand, the priest has died after half saying the formula for the consecration of the blood, well, then the host has already been consecrated. So the consecration has begun. It's been done in the form of the host. Then another priest is to complete the Mass, repeating the whole formula over the same chalice, or he may say the whole formula over another chalice which has been prepared, and consume the first priest's host and the blood consecrated by himself, and then the chalice which was half consecrated. So you bring in a new priest, and he finishes the Mass from the point the first priest died, as long as he got all the way through the consecration of the host.
Wow, that is really cool that was thought down. And you can see the theology behind that thinking too. I mean, it all makes perfect theological sense. It's amazing. What is the other thing is, all of this has probably happened.
Oh, yeah. Like, 2,000 years with thousands of Catholic priests in the world, this has happened. Yeah.
Yeah. I must say, Jimmy, I'm a little curious about what you're supposed to do if there's a spider in the chalice. Do you happen to remember that one? Because you raised that, and I'm like, well, what do you do?
So basically, if it's before the consecration of the precious blood, you can just dump it out.
Yeah.
Because it's not consecrated.
Right.
If it's after the consecration of the precious blood, and it's safe to do this, now, this wouldn't apply if like the spider was crushed and its venom went out into the precious blood.
Right.
But if you can just pluck out the spider and it's got some of the precious blood on it. So you wash it with water to dissolve the appearances of wine.
Right.
And with the dissolution of the appearances of wine, the real presence ceases.
Yeah.
And then you pour the water down the sacrarium and then you can burn the spider.
Okay. Now I know what to do if Father's ever on and he's like, hey, there's a I'm not giving out the phone number because it's an internet open forum. This one comes from Joe for Jimmy. What is
you want to know what you do if it freezes?
Yeah. Yes.
You get hot cloths soaked in water, like hot water, and you put them around the basis of the chalice so that the heat will go through the metal of the chalice and thaw out the precious blood.
Now I've got that one covered too. De Defectibus is the book. As I said, this one comes from Joe. What's your take? Okay, Joe, here we go. What's your take on the irresistible force paradox? What would happen if an unstoppable force encountered an unmovable object?
Okay, so this is a conceptual paradox because if a force is genuinely unstoppable, then it should be able to move anything that it encounters. But if an object is genuinely unmovable, then it should not be able to be moved by anything that is encountering it. So which one of these would rule? Well, I think that like a variety of paradoxes, this is just a verbal trick. It's kind of like if I were to say, you know, I went down to IKEA yesterday and I bought a desk and I bought this really great desk. It's made entirely out of wood. Oh, and I forgot to mention the desk that I bought, it's entirely made out of water ice.
Oh yeah. Right. Okay. I see what you're saying.
Okay. It can't be both. It can't be entirely wood and entirely water ice. I can say that,
right.
But that doesn't mean a desk like that could really exist because it contains a logical contradiction. Something can't be entirely wood and entirely water ice. Well, I think that's all we have here. You can say there's this unstoppable force or irresistible force and it encounters an immovable object. What happens?
Yeah.
It's like, well, okay, you've just described a logical contradiction, and so no such thing exists. If either there is no unstoppable force, or there is no genuinely unstoppable force, or there is no genuinely immovable object, reality does not permit logical contradictions to exist, and so every force in existence is either going to be stoppable by something, or every object in existence mm-hmm. is going to be movable by something, or both. So I think this is just, it's like my entirely wood, entirely ice desk. It's something you can say, but it entails a logical contradiction and could not exist in reality.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the question, Joe. It leaves me with that debated philosophical question. What happens if the Hulk fights Spider-Man?
Hulk wins.
Oh, really?
At least in terms of physical strength, Hulk wins.
Oh, all right. All right.
Now, Spider-Man might outsmart him, but in brute force, Hulk wins.
All right. We've solved one. Joe, we couldn't solve yours because it was just... I hate to say it,
but we solved it.
Yeah,
we rejected the horns of the dilemma.
There you go, right there. But now we know that the Hulk would beat Spider-Man. That's important knowledge. Take that into the weekend with you. We got one more hour of Internet Open Forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Lots of great questions. I know that because I get to look ahead. And we got lots of great questions coming up right after this on Catholic Answers Live.